You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to Tea Break Time Travel, where every month we look at a different archaeological object and take you on a journey into their past.
Hello and welcome to episode 22 of Tea Break Time Travel. I am your host, Mathilde Siebrecht. Today I am savouring an orange chai rooibos tea. I couldn't decide which one to put first. It's like one of those naming lists where you have to have different adjectives in a certain order, but I'm going with orange chai rooibos tea. And joining me on my tea break today is archaeologist and presenter Natasha Bilson. So welcome, Natasha. And are you also on tea today?
Hello. Yes, I am. I'm having just a bog standard English breakfast tea. I mean, nothing special, but it's Yorkshire, good old Yorkshire tea.
And is that then black? Is it with milk?
Oh, no, with milk. And I'm going through a phase of having sugar again, which is quite rare for me. I mean, I have not had sugar in my tea for 10, 15 years. And I don't know, it's all about the sugar at the moment.
Sometimes we just need that little sweet, savoury thing. Yes. And I'm curious, so I'm not a big black tea drinker. I just sort of drink whatever's black tea is given to me. But I did a poll on my Instagram at some point recently to say, what is your favourite kind of tea? And so many people said Earl Grey. And then we're sort of saying, oh, not that English breakfast, rubbish, Earl Grey. Ooh, I didn't know there was that much of a difference.
There's difference. No, wait. Yeah. English breakfast is basically a standard black tea. Uh-huh. I mean, you're more of a tea. You don't know more about tea than I do. But for me, it's just like black tea. And it could be stronger, maybe a bit weaker, depending what type of leaves you have. And then you have Earl Grey, which is like a sweeter black tea. So by itself, you don't need sugar. For someone who likes sugar in their tea, you could substitute maybe for an Earl Grey because it's just naturally sweeter.
Oh, I did not know this. I think maybe that's why I didn't, because my parents always used to drink English breakfast. So that's why I didn't really drink black tea growing up, because it was always a bit too bitter for me.
I mean, I personally don't, I need milk in my tea.
Yeah,
I do need milk. Yeah, unless I'm unwell. Like, we only have black tea with sugar if you're sick, you know. That's the only time that you drink black tea. That's how I associate black tea.
Okay.
With myself, anyway. I was forced to drink black tea with toast.
Okay, fair enough. So, see, I think I drink black tea now because I don't really drink coffee, so I drink black tea in the morning if I need to wake up. But yes, anyway, good. Well, that's good. I've learned something already. I'm going to go and try some Earl Grey because I don't think
it's lovely. You need some Earl Grey in your life.
Yeah. Interesting. I will go and try that today. But anyway, I didn't ask you to come on here for your tea expertise, even though that's apparently endless.
I have none.
I came on to ask you about your archaeological expertise. And one of the things I ask all of my guests, and everyone's given such a different story, is the kind of road that they took to get to an archaeological sort of specialization or focus. So what was it about archaeology that made you want to be an archaeologist? Or how did it come about, I guess?
Yeah, great question. How am I feeling today? Let's see.
Well, I hate archaeology. I don't want to be an archaeologist again.
Well, as a commercial field archaeologist, having a background in that, that does come every few years. You do question your life choices.
Complain.
Yes. Honestly, today is one of those days when my wrists are just like, what have I done in my life? Oh. And my back. But, you know, that's the sacrifice you make for understanding the past and following your passions. So for me, I would say that I've been quite fortunate to always be surrounded with the curiosity to learn about our past and what connects us in today's society through shared heritage. So, you know, growing up, my mother was fascinated with ancient Egypt. We had tons of pictures and random little, you know, brick and brac artifacts that you know, kind of based on those things that you have in people's houses. So my mum has loads of those.
Yeah.
And then in my primary school, it was bombed in World War I or World War II. And we had this memorabilia covered in the corridors. I just always had this memory of walking from one class to another and having just these corridors filled with all these random artifacts and memorabilia from the war.
So cool.
So I think having those two kind of contrast with modern history versus ancient history, as well as being, you know, in England where we have all these historic churches and landscapes, buildings all around us, you're constantly reminded of the past in a positive way. I would say. So like the local park, again, you have a lovely church that was recorded from Doomsday, so 1066. We have this consensus that's made in England. Once we have the Normans come into power, we see everything basically be documented. So we have this record of churches, for instance. around England. So I think all of these aspects have really ignited that passion and desire to know more about the past.
Okay. And you mentioned, like you say, sort of ancient history, more modern history. Do you have a preference in terms of that? I mean, would you do commercial archaeology, but would you also call yourself a bit of a historian?
Yeah, this is a weird one. I feel like in the public sphere, I would say, like on social media and things, I would say like a public historian sometimes I would use quite loosely, because I feel that there is this thin bridge between both in the public space. Obviously, like academically, it is different. We look and we interpret things in a different light. But I don't know, maybe public historian, maybe, because I don't feel like I don't specialize in one area in particular. And that is because of being a commercial archaeologist, you have to have a breadth of knowledge about everything. Right. You have to know how to identify something just looking at it, spot dating, having characteristics of each time period. Everything has like a telltale sign.
Yeah.
Whether it be the smell, I know smell is kind of a weird thing to say, but sometimes there's a smell when something changes, the deposit. Actually, that tells you nothing. You just know something's like, oh, that smells.
I'm going to break. Someone else can take over in this game. Yeah.
But, you know, there's like, it feels different as you excavate something, layer upon layer, the compaction, the inclusions, these all are telltale signs of something being different. So you have to know a bit about everything. And I don't really have a passion era. I would say it changes all the time. Like every 6 months to a year, it just changes. It depends what I'm doing, I would say. And it inspires curiosity to research that area.
I guess, would there be a favorite kind of period or region or area that you would want to excavate more than anything else?
Not necessarily
have an interest in, but kind of the physical.
This is difficult as well, you know, because I've worked on a lot of different archaeological sites around the world. I've been very fortunate to have that experience, to not only be international field expeditions led by actual local archaeologists, I'm just joining their team as the one foreign person, which is good in itself, but great experience to learn language on the spot, being the only one who doesn't speak that said language. I don't know, because I've done a bit of everything. I would like to go back and do a bit more maritime archaeology, I would say, because I haven't done that for a while. That's one thing I would like to have done more of. I did that during my undergraduate, originally when I was going to do archaeology at Bournemouth University, which is just amazing for archaeology.
Also maritime archaeology, right? They have a big,
They're brilliant. I mean, I would say I did Romans. Roman archaeology was kind of my thing and still is my thing. I can't answer this.
It's fine. You know? We've got a whole podcast episode to discuss the answer to this question. Maybe if we can talk about the object at some point, that would be cool as well.
Yeah, I know. I'm interested in everything. That's the short answer.
But that's really interesting as well. I think a lot of people assume that they have to specialize. So it's nice to hear that you can still be, you know, have broad interests and still make a career out of it. Like it's not a limiting factor.
True.
Yeah, in that respect. So yes, cool. Thank you for sharing. The other question that I always ask all of my guests, of course, this is Tea Break Time Travel. We will be traveling back in time today, but today we have a set course. But if you could travel back in time to anywhere in history, where would you go, or when would you go, I should say, and why?
I'm thinking, because we're talking about the Sutton Hoo helmet, it'd be great to actually go back in time and see what was happening, the atmosphere of how the locals were feeling prior to this individual who was laid to rest. Actually, I want to see who this person was. So maybe a bit further back in time. Give me about at least 1 year. Six months before. No, I'm actually scared of moving 6 months. I'll probably die. Let's try like a week. No. They'll probably be dying as well. I don't know.
But the second that they die, go and quickly say, who are you?
Who are you? Where do you come from? Like, what life lessons could you give? Yeah, it'd be great to document this person, because their burial, as we will discuss in this episode, is just so fascinating. And I think for the fact that we're talking about this, I'd love to go back in time and see what was happening, how this ship burial was even done, like how they maneuvered it, how they built the ship. I want to see how they built the ship. You know, like, I want to see everything about this burial site.
So before, like, 6 months to a year before.
I'm kind of worried to go that far back in time, though, because I honestly think I would die. I don't think I could survive.
Well, if we did it as sort of a fly on the wall type thing, like we go in our little bubble, we don't actually interact, or would you want to interact?
Oh, this is a hard one. Okay, have you read the book? Oh, what is that book called? Where it's about like witches and vampires.
Discovery of Witches?
Yes, that's the one.
I've actually literally just started reading the first one.
Have you?
So no spoilers.
Oh, okay. Oh, damn it, I can't tell you.
Well, I do know like already that in the second one it's set in the Elizabethan era, so I imagine.
That's true, but how she's able to jump back and forth, you know? Not really jump, but... Actually, you know what? She lives. Okay, I can't say it now. Kind of like that.
Sorry.
For anyone who's read the book, kind of like that, I wouldn't mind. But even that is quite close and personal. I like the idea of jumping in and out when I want to, so I'm safe. Mm. Maybe I have like a magic ring or a torque or something, and I just like rub it, and then I'm back.
Back home. I don't know. Yeah. And just hope that the magic doesn't wear out in a really awkward moment.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it is convenient that you said you wanted to go back that far. We're not going back. Well, maybe we're going back. We're keeping it very vague. Because before we talk a little bit more about, yes, indeed, the Sutton Hoo burial, it's been teased already. Let's first journey back to the early 7th century. Very vague. In what we now call England. It's a sunny day, but the air above the watching crowd is somber. All eyes on the huge 27-meter-long ship that lies before them, still being filled with cases of gold jewellery, bags of rubies, stacks of silver plates. At last, the stackers move aside to make room for 4 men carrying a stretcher, on which lies a richly dressed figure, hands clasped over their chest, eyes closed. If possible, the hush falls even more, the crowd watching in silent respect as the figure is manoeuvred into the central chamber of the ship. On their right-hand side is laid a sword and a selection of spears. On their left, a beautifully decorated helmet is wrapped carefully in a cloth before being set gently down. It takes a long time for the burial mound to be built over this ship, even longer before the weight of the mound eventually crushes the central chamber, so that when it is finally excavated in 1939, all that is left of that wonderful helmet are hundreds of rusted fragments. So indeed, today we'll be looking, well, at the Sutton Hoo helmet, but also the rest of the burial in general. And we'll get into the details very soon. But first of all, let's have a very quick break.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Welcome back, everyone. So we are going to have a look, as always, at the most asked questions on the internet, all about the Sutton Hoo helmet specifically. I was going to do it about the Sutton Hoo burial, but I thought, let's get specific. Let's talk about the Sutton Hoo helmet. And actually, there's a surprising amount of questions about this, probably thanks to the film The Dig. I guess that sort of garnered interest in this burial and this object. So the first question that always came up is, what is the Sutton Hoo helmet made of? Can you enlighten us, Tash?
Yes. So I do love the Sutton Hoo helmet, so I'm very excited about this. I'll try to be as concise as possible for you listeners out there. So I want you to imagine that the helmet is primarily made of iron, but what really sets it apart are these decorative elements. It's adorned with panels of tinned copper alloy sheeting, which are then stamped with these intricate patterns, which include animal interlace and warrior motifs. But for me, it's those motifs that are fascinating. There's the dancing warrior and the fallen warrior scenes, which are just so vivid. Then there's this crest running over the top of the helmet, which is made of iron. with this gilt animal terminals, and those animals even have garnet eyes.
Oh, so wow.
You can just imagine the beauty it must have had in its actual state, which you do see in a reconstruction piece in the British Museum. I think it's in Gallery 41.
Okay. I was about to say, I thought that was a reconstruction because I remember when I was younger, I always thought that was the original. I was thinking, oh my goodness, that's so well, you know?
There's a funny story. I was recently at the British Museum showing some friends some of the best bits, had 30 minutes. Uh-huh. And I was explaining the Sutton Hoo helmet and they were looking at the real one. And it was my mistake that I was explaining it. And they're looking and they're just like, how does this survive? And I'm like, what? And then it was my husband who was like, no, it's this one. Because I was just so I went into the zone about explaining the significance. And I just went in and my husband was like, no, you're looking at the wrong thing. It's this one on the right.
And then they're like, pile of rusted metal here.
Yeah, glued onto this shell of what the helmet would have looked like. So.
Which also, God, if it's made of iron, that must be so heavy as well.
Yeah, I can't, I've tried on Roman reconstruction helmets, so I can only imagine how that would have felt.
Yeah.
But it's the parcel gilt features, especially around the nose and the mouthpiece. The fact that it's a helmet and a face, it's face covering. You're completely covered. 360, you're protected.
Yeah.
So it's you can just imagine, this was not worn by your average warrior.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, something very interesting. It's funny, actually, when you were talking about warrior, the different warrior poses, I did some yoga this morning. It was all, peaceful warrior or whatever. And I was like, it's basically just yoga poses on the Sutton Hoo helmet. But no, indeed, of course, very, very regal, very aggressive. I shouldn't be talking about it like that. And so that leads actually very nicely into the second question, which was, what was the Sutton Hoo helmet used for? Because I can imagine that if it's something that intricately decorated, surely it wasn't actually functional, or do you think it might have been functional?
Oh, there's so many debates around this.
Yeah.
And there's a great discussion piece by Dr. Sue Brunning, who is the curator at the British Museum. And so she oversees the Sutton Hoo. And if you go onto YouTube, please, I recommend watching Curator's Corner with Dr. Sue Brunning, because it's one of my favorite videos of her explaining some of the Sutton Hoo artifacts, which includes the sword, as well as the helmet in question. And she does a great blog, by the way, that covers the Netflix The Dig versus reality. And I think that's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, yeah, loads of us made YouTube videos at the time explaining it, but of course, she is the expert.
She knows her stuff.
She literally oversees it at the British Museum, so watch that if you've got 15 minutes, so there is speculation around the helmet because it is found amongst grave goods, burial sites. So was it ceremonial rather than combat? I think so. I mean, the elaborate design, the craftsmanship, it suggests it was meant to signify status and power, perhaps worn by a king or high-ranking warrior during important events or rituals, maybe. You always see those kind of in films.
Ritual.
And yeah, ritual, exactly. When an archaeologist doesn't know, it's ritual. And maybe it is in this case as well.
Yeah.
I mean, because, it's a helmet that does, as I said earlier, it covers, it's 360, so it could offer protection. But it's the fact that, as you said, the intricate decoration and symbolism points to its role, I would say, maybe displaying authority, lineage. It connects the wearer both to this earthly kingdom and the divine. So maybe more ritual side, ceremonial purpose, I think.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. I mean, that's what makes time travel, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Because maybe everyone was wearing these, It was just who doesn't have a garnet encrusted iron helmet these days? So, okay, well, that's sort of, because you mentioned as well, it probably was worn by someone important. So that was indeed one of the other questions, was who wore the Sutton Hoo helmet, but maybe we'll get into that a little bit further later. But one of the questions that actually I was surprised that it came up so often, but I guess maybe because of the film The Dig, one of the questions that came up was, why is the Sutton Hoo helmet so important?
Yes, so the Sutton Hoo helmet is one of four known in the archaeological record in England from the early medieval period. Now, its discovery at Sutton Hoo is among one of the most spectacular archaeological finds in the UK. And that's for the time period, I would say, because obviously this is all personal preference. So for that time period, I would say this ship burial is just by itself, wow. Honestly, wow. So the helmet with its intricate designs and craftsmanship, I would say, challenges the outdated notion of the Dark Ages, quote unquote, which at the time was this, you know, cultural decline, and they saw that time period as being quite literally Dark Ages. So I think this discovery in itself changed the perception of the medieval era. So I think that in itself is really, really significant, and we kind of need to know in itself. And maybe that's why I got so much media attention.
Yeah. Which, was it at the time people already were like, oh, actually this is from this time period? Or did they not believe it was from that time period? Like, how did that go about in terms of kind of the acceptance then of that new idea? Because I can imagine it was quite a difficult pill to swallow for some people to admit actually the Middle Ages might have not been quite so dark as we thought they were.
I think if I remember correctly, there were some, was it journals, or there was some rifts between the archaeologists, I think they were from the British Museum actually, or the local museums, versus the archaeologists on site excavating, when the archaeologists on site were saying, look, this is something I think from this time period. And everyone's like, no, don't, you know, like, no way. Yeah, don't be ridiculous. What are you saying? Yeah. And you're finding, you know, iron and it's shiny. Like, obviously it would have been that shiny, but you know, you're finding all these artifacts. Bearing in mind, actually, the artifacts recovered on the site were not really looked at until later on, because obviously World War II.
Right. Yeah.
So that's why we really only have a full understanding of the artifacts and the significance of the burials later on in time.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're talking about it in the press, saying that there is this amazing discovery, but I would say the significance of it wasn't really fully understood until the artifacts themselves were actually looked at by specialist teams, which were, I think, in the 50s, 40s or 50s. It was post-World War II that these artifacts were really studied further. Okay. So I think it was a long time coming, and one of the many archaeological discoveries that changed the perception of what medieval England was.
Yeah, which is, I mean, yeah, pretty radical, radical change. Yes, different change.
It was. Yeah. But, you know, it's not, yeah, as I said, so it wasn't just about the helmet, it's what it represented. So, you know, the wealth, the artistry, the societal structures of the Anglo-Saxons. So for many, it gave a glimpse into the world that what we perceive as valuing heroism, craftsmanship and status. And, you know, I would think it's this tangible connection to a past, you know, thanks to this helmet and the other artifacts found with it, that it isn't as lost to history as we might have thought.
Yeah.
And that it's really a reminder, as I said again, it's this reminder of complexity and richness of the societies that came before us. Mm. And, you know, how artifacts like the Sutton Hoo helmet can tell stories, not just of individuals, but of entire cultures.
Yeah. And because you mentioned that the Sutton Hoo helmet is just one of four found. So drawing on your expertise as a commercial archaeologist in terms of knowing a lot of different ground types and everything, obviously with metal, I mean, do you think that there might have been more potential of these kind of excavations, and either we haven't found them yet or they just haven't preserved well? Because if I remember from the film, which shows how much I know about this site, for example, the boat wasn't there anymore. It was just kind of the outline of the planks sort of thing. Like the preservation of all the objects was incredible, but there was also a lot that wasn't preserved. Is there something in the particular soil types in that region that would enable it to be preserved more so in other regions? Do you know?
If memory serves, the geology of that area where the burial mound was found, it was quite close to the river, hence how they were able to bring the boat and create this mound. Uh-huh. So water would have been close enough. You know, logistically, how the hell did they get this boat here?
Yes.
You know, there's a river nearby, it's water source. So that it's going to be a bit more waterlogged or water rich, I would say the soils are, which is probably why this sort of ghost shell of the outline of the ship survived. Yeah. Now, as you said, it's all about the acidity. Mm-hmm. Is that the correct way? Acidity or the alkaline levels in the soils that help us determine what the hell we're looking at. You know, there's some sites that are just amazing, and you've got this unbelievable wood preservation like, I'm just thinking now, I've got a glimpse in my head of a site we did in Oxford in the town centre. Massive, massive site. And the wood preservation is the best I've ever seen.
Okay.
So good that we were even getting, you know, leather shoes, just like Vindolanda. That's when you know it's good, yeah? It's those good, beautiful, rich soils that are able to hold these artefacts and not deteriorate them. Yeah, they don't decompose.
Yeah.
Because it's all organic matter. But when it comes to, you know, iron, copper, these metals, these are harder to break down.
Okay.
So I said there's other factors involved into how it can degradate. So, I mean, as you mentioned before, the helmet was in pieces, small pieces. It took like 25 years for them to piece it together.
Oh, wow.
And who knows, you know, if they've really got it in the right place. You know,
that's a good point. What if it's actually a completely, what if what we've described as amazing and fantastic is not it at all?
Exactly. Who knows?
Oh, wow.
I mean, it took like 25 years, so it should be okay, hopefully.
Yeah, you'd hope.
You'd hope. But I mean, I guess it's the most realistic formation. I mean, I'm not a conservator, but I'm assuming it. There's a lot of things that go get play to recreate something. But again, it's all artistic license in itself with what they perceive.
And I mean, is this then a reconstruction that happened kind of directly after it was, well, or not even directly after it was excavated? Because as you said, there was the war. But like, has it been reassessed?
Because if I remember correctly, it was first constructed and then they disagreed. And then later on, it was dismantled and recreated, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And that's why it's like kind of over a 25-year period that it's kind of looked at, you know, back and forth, where they get it to where it is today, what we see.
Which is important, right?
Like, it is. Yeah, it is. I mean, obviously time, money, skills.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reconstructed helmet, I think, was made by the Royal Armour. So obviously that's artistic license in itself, using other sources to kind of create what they think that they may have, like the motifs that we see.
Okay.
Obviously from other, inspired by other reliefs in other settings.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But no, it is funny to think that maybe it's completely.
Well, you know, in a way, is that not when we excavate something and we interpret it? It's an interpretation, but where does that interpretation and that knowledge come from? It's collective as well as individual memories and associations and scientific understanding. But it's this collection of all this data where we're able to say, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
You know, we're kind of 80% sure, because you can't be 100% sure of anything, especially when you're dealing with the past.
No. I can still remember, I'm so reluctant in any of my writing now to write something like, we know this, because we're like, but we don't, we can't know it. And it's like, wait, no, this is about something different, Matilda, it's
possibly,
fine.
Potentially.
Potentially suggest, I think, is the most word.
Which suggests could be.
That, you know, doesn't it? I'm just hedging all my bets here. Not putting down.
I feel like we should create like a little archaeologist guide to trying to describe something without, you know, shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah. Without giving an actual like solid conclusion. I think that that's, I don't know, I personally think that that's a really great way to look at the world in general, though, to not just see it in black and white, and then you see, right, there's a lot of nuances in lots of different things, and actually it's all based on your own interpretation.
So true. It's like, if you want to get really philosophical and off key, you know, what is history?
Exactly.
What is the past? Does the past happen from a moment ago, or is the past 100 years ago? So, it's all those kind of deep questions sometimes.
Well, but even like you say, like this Sutton Hoo burial, it was, you know, it was an important burial because it made historians completely reassess their whole understanding of history. So what if, you know, something else happens in the next 10 years, we have another kind of site which completely makes us rethink or reinterpret a period of history or a culture or something like that.
I think that's the beauty of it, really. That's the beauty of archaeological excavation and people looking in, even in the archives, and rediscovering, you know, books that they thought were lost, like the Book of Hours of, what was his name? One of the, I think it was in the Tudor period. I've forgotten already. It's to do with Tudor history. So not really my forte, but there's a painting with this book, and they found the book in Oxford Library. So it was lost for hundreds of years. I think like 400 years it was lost. So, you know, discoveries can be found everywhere.
Yeah.
At this point.
Well, or even like you mentioned, the new techniques. We've just finished reading for the book club, the Archaeo Book Club thing. We finished reading Kindred by Rebecca Rowe Sykes. Mm. And it was really interesting because she was talking about how, you know, indeed, so many perceptions that were had of the Neanderthals. And then you had all these different techniques that have been used that actually then give a whole other picture. So it's the same material that's being looked at, but just in a different way as well, which is also really interesting. Mm. So many different things to be looked at. Anyway, gone slightly off piece, sorry. But I do think that this burial almost represents that idea in a way, is what you were saying before as well.
All about perception. And you're right. This is a really significant object that not only shows the significant importance of the leader who was buried, who was laid to rest in this beautiful earth mound, but it's also more, as you said, the nuances around how we interpret the past.
Yeah. And just sort of a final, I guess, thing about the burial itself then, because the helmet itself is amazing, but of course there's so many other incredible things in this burial. And am I right in thinking that there's also some things that come from like surprisingly far away?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, there's like rubies from Sri Lanka.
Right? I had read that somewhere.
It's unbelievable when you look at, it's actually, I remember when I was doing the research for my overview of Netflix, The Dig, and the real archaeology behind it. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking like, wow. Like this shows trade interaction with other cultures around the world. Yeah. And it's a fantastic example of that, really, through these artifacts, through these objects, which we know did not originate in Europe at the time. They're from further afield. And having that in this place, you know, of all places, like you would not expect that now, because today's society is you know, London centric. It's based in the south of England. Back then, it was a completely different game. Like, you know, England or the UK was divided in a different way. Yeah. So the way trade interaction was happening were with different kingdoms, effectively. Yeah. So I think that in itself is just like, wow, it is. Yeah. It's truly unbelievable. Yeah. So you had like the silver bowls and spoons from the Byzantine, and then you've got this gold dress accessory sets with Sri Lankan garnets.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it was garnets, not rubies.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's, you know, some of over like 250 artifacts that we know were recovered. I bet there were more. They just were not retrieved.
Right. Yeah, of course. Or maybe, yeah, got lost during excavation or post-excavation. Or
exactly. It happens. You know, bearing in mind, practices that we have now were not adopted back then.
Right.
And every year, every decade, archaeological excavations and post-excavation techniques changes and it evolves and it becomes better. We are less likely to miss these minute details, like very small artifacts. It's quite hard to, it is easy to miss sometimes if you're not sieving through the soils that are taken up with these said artifacts. You're very likely to, obviously, as well, back then, no metal detectors to just give like a once over to make sure you're not missing any metal objects.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And I guess that like things like the helmet would have sort of probably still been kind of recognizable as something interesting. So that's why they kept it. But there might have been, I guess, more things that weren't considered interesting, or, you know, they weren't considered as.
You know, exactly. What is interesting?
Yeah.
That in itself, like you actually see that in the archaeological record, that the archaeologists, depending where they are in the world, this is like literally worldwide information, is that you see in archaeological records like 30, 40 years ago, you can see how they interpret information and what they deem as important to record, to actually document on a piece of paper versus what is not. And you see gaps, you see these anomalies, and you start to see these patterns of, okay, this is not significant for them.
Yeah.
We see that in so many different types of archaeological situations.
Which then also has such a big effect on current archaeological things. And that's, I always try to tell people, like, be really careful, like, check what people are citing and check what people's sources are. Because if people are saying, oh, yes, but, and look, this has been important for 50 or 100 or 1,000 years or whatever, and then you're like, yes, but if you're citing these antiquarian interpretations, those interpretations were very, limited.
You know, it makes me question how even I have in the past documented, recorded something that I have seen, because we do not deem certain artifacts as significant. We just drop them on a piece of paper. We don't even keep them anymore because we have such a large quantity of these said objects.
Right.
Yet if you were to speak to someone in America or Australia, they're keeping every single part of this post-medieval material.
Right. Yeah.
But for us, we're literally like, okay, we found stoneware bossel, we just write it. We might sample one or two that are different. So we'll just take samples of them, but we wouldn't keep all of it.
Right. Yeah.
We may document how many we have. We could take some measurements on site. But generally speaking, you know, the post-ex team who are in the office, they will tell us, no, we don't need it, or yes, we need this.
Yeah.
And they may look at it, they may document it, and then they have to discard it afterwards. Not everything is saved because there's not enough space.
This is the thing, right? I mean, there's no possible way that we could save every single thing from antiquity or history or anything.
No, there's not. And we have an abundance of archaeological material in the UK. So it's making that call. And there's so many issues you'll see in the news where we are having storage issues and archive issues.
Yeah. So maybe someone in the past didn't think that helmets were important, so they just chucked out a bunch of...
Exactly. They're like, oh, they used to be hundreds. Yeah. You know, maybe they weren't like the Romans who, you know, if someone had fallen, they would keep the armour.
Oh, right.
Because that's where all the money is, right? That's why it's so rare to find them buried.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, you get, they keep them. That's where the money is. They need that, you know. Yeah. That soldier, that sword costs. But yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to have another quick break, give people a chance to top up their tea, but we'll be back very soon with more. Welcome back, everyone. I hope that your tea has been topped up, maybe with some lovely fragrant Earl Grey, which is apparently a lot sweeter than English breakfast. Who knew? So thank you so, so much, Tash, for telling us all about the wonderful Sutton Hoo helmet and burial, and we did get quite philosophical in the end as well. But we already introduced your work a little bit in the first section of this episode, but maybe we could go into a little bit more detail now, because as well as doing commercial archaeology, you, of course, are a presenter, a public historian, as you quoted at the beginning. So how did that kind of first come about? How did you first get into doing kind of TV work, other forms of media outreach?
Well, I regret calling myself a public historian now. No, you know what? This is the thing. It's so great what you said there, is that TV work, you know, it's a different medium in itself. You have to be adaptable to be able to get the work effectively. So I started, I think my first job was actually in Ukraine. I was doing a lot of translating work from Russian and Ukrainian to English.
Okay.
And that's where, you know, that was through my husband, who had friends in Ukraine at the time who worked in production. And I was visiting him quite often. And I was getting something to do, to learn, and something more fun, because we were thinking of, I lived in Ukraine for a little bit.
Okay.
And it became like one of my jobs. And then when I was in between coming back, you know, digging in London, I'd use all my toll time. So time accrued from traveling and all my annual leave, I'd fly over to Ukraine, see my husband, and then and then do this TV work. So that was from 2016.
Okay.
I was doing 2016 or 2017. I started doing the sort of dubbing, voiceover work. Mm-hmm. And then from that transpired into them saying, you know, do you want to try and do some stuff for TV or for our online channels? And I'm like, okay, let's try this. That's really where I got my skills started to develop.
Okay.
In UK, USA media, the first real kind of opportunity fell in 2019 when I was able to fly to Egypt to do a show called The Unexplained and Unexplored. Mm-hmm. Some amazing explorers who were traveling, you know, all over the world to, you know, try and answer these legends of where these artifacts were. And I was on the episode, I think, where they're looking for the Ark of Covenant.
Oh,
and
cool.
You know, it was good fun.
Proper Indiana Jones style.
Yeah, it was fun. And they were so great just to chat to in general. Such a lovely team to work with. And that was my first TV experience. I've been thinking, oh my goodness, like, this is quite scary. I've been flown to Egypt to talk about, you know, what was I talking about? I forgot now what I was talking about. But what it was that I had done some research on prior, because I'd worked in Egypt as well. And yes, yeah, so I was able to talk about this. I'm very random. Like, I've actually, honestly, when I say I've traveled all over the world, I really have to work. So yeah, my first TV job was there, and that was with Discovery and Science Channel. From that, I started doing panel TV shows, which is where you're a talking head. You're one of many people in the studio explaining a story. And that's why I say I'm sometimes like a public historian or a public archaeologist, of course, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Where I'm a part of many people explaining, generally speaking, the mysteries, the unexplored answers for an artifact or a civilization. So they always have mysteries in the title, but that's just
because. Of course. It's, you know, yeah. I use that a lot as well. All of my things, mysterious object. We have no idea what it was used for. Well, we kind of do, but, you know.
you always got to start it off like that, don't you? You start it off like, oh, what is this? You know, you question it and then you get into the nitty gritty.
Exactly.
So all those TV shows have that format where you're questioning at the beginning, then you start to answer. And there's a group of you who are doing that. You don't know each other effectively because you're all different expertise.
Yeah.
You know, you have an archaeologist, an engineer, an architect, like, you know, it depends what you're talking about, what the subject of the show is. And your job is to explain from your perspective the said object in question.
Which I guess that also must have meant that you had to have an extremely broad knowledge base.
So much research, honestly. Like, so you're filming. So when I say with these panel shows, sometimes you're doing 6 episodes to 8 episodes in one day.
Oh, wow.
So it's a 12-hour shoot. And, you know, just like this dark room, just lights on you. You're filmed in a certain way. So you've got this bright light and then you've got a producer just asking you questions about said subject. Now, you know, prior to the interview, you already know the subjects and what they want you to cover.
Right.
So it helps with the research.
Yeah.
Sometimes they send you their research notes. But obviously, depending if you've worked with the producers or not, you want to fact check every single thing that they've said,
yes.
And which they're happy with, you know, you doing as well.
Okay, that's good.
You know, and then once you build like a really good rapport with these production companies, it becomes a bit easier because then you know how they work and you're like, oh, okay, they've really researched this.
Yeah,
I don't have to worry too much. Yeah, I can trust them. If sometimes when you're talking, they might say, oh, do you think you could say this on this, like hint towards that, and sometimes you do, sometimes you don't want to. It's your choice, you know.
I was going to ask about that actually, whether that's happened to you before with,
yeah,
you know, especially with these sort of programs that are almost slightly on the edge of the suiting, you know, the kind of really going.
Well, this is the thing. This is the thing. So all those shows start with that, and it's really difficult, especially when you know how it's going to be edited.
Mm.
So. You know that the beginning, they're going to tease it in this way, and then they'll give you an opportunity to explain it, generally speaking.
Okay.
So even if you tease in this sort of, oh, this mystery looks so unlike anything we've seen before, who could have made this?
Yeah.
They might cut that and put that in the trailer or in the beginning. You'll also have opportunity later on to dive into it and say, actually, you know, at first glance, we think it's this, but really when you look into it, it's not mystery.
Yeah.
We can know these people made it using these tools. We have these objects in the archaeological record. So there are times when you have to tease that. And it's really hard when there's ones that are kind of based on this... How to say this politely? You know when? So I've recently I've done the show hasn't aired yet, and there's one that kind of looks at the aliens and the UFO speculation, more UFO speculation. And what I actually really found interesting about the show when they pitched it to me, I've worked with this production company on maybe 4 or 5 different shows over the last 4 years, so I know them really well. And I had a chat with them when they pitched to me. I said, like, I've read this. I need to see your notes. I want to see where you're going with it. Like, I need to see everything. And I understood actually what they're doing is, because I said to them, look, I don't want to like upset people who really believe in this stuff.
Right.
Like, it's not, because these people who really do believe in it, and I've met them, and they're fanatics, but that's their world, right? They really believe in UFO sightings in Falkirk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, I didn't realize, is like the hotspot in Europe.
Right.
For these sightings, and they really, really believe in it. So you can't just be like, oh, no, dismiss them straight away, because that hurts them. They're offended.
They're
upset.
They're defensive.
Yeah. So sometimes there's a way of doing where you acknowledge that that's what they think. And then what I loved about the show was then we actually talk about, okay, this is why we think people are seeing this, because we have these, you know, 3 airports are really close by. You get a lot of air traffic in this region and it's continuous, you know.
Yeah.
Then we've got military bases nearby as well.
Yeah.
So all these factors could lead to why people have these so-called sightings.
Yeah.
And it's just putting a bit of another perspective on why these people think that without offending them, you know, because it's not nice.
And I think that that's a really interesting point as well, because I can remember when a certain Netflix alleged documentary, even though it definitely wasn't a documentary, came out, and there was a lot of, you know, lashback from it in the archaeological community. But then, indeed, I remember having a whole discussion about it with some of my colleagues, and some of them were pointing out, like, yeah, but that's exactly the wrong approach to take, because if you just say, no, this is all wrong, it's all false, then you're just playing into the kind of
assumption. Into the narrative that we have been painted by popular pseudoscientists.
Exactly, yeah. And, so I think that's a really good point you make, to that it needs to be acknowledged, but then approached in a kind of different way. Like,
because, everything's interpretation.
Yeah.
You know,
as we've said.
Yeah, it's interpretation. Yeah. We have scientific backing, which is, again, a number of people supporting it, right? When you put an article in for a journal, it's peer reviewed.
Yeah.
So that's the process. And the issue we have with these pseudoscientists is that their research is not peer reviewed.
Yeah.
But that's not said publicly. People are just bashing them, saying, "Oh, you're wrong."
Yeah. Exactly.
So that's not helpful at all to all these people who listen to the podcast as well. I've had like family friends come up to me and be like, "Oh yeah, I listen to this podcast with them." We're being vague about this on purpose, but I hope you know who we're talking about. I listen to this podcast, like, you know, obviously got millions of hits. I'm going to buy the book. And I said, look, you can buy the book. I go, look, if you want to, you can. But
you should
also. I've spoken to friends who have really said that it's actually really historically inaccurate and archaeologically inaccurate.
Yeah.
I go, and it's just what you have to understand is the thing that we must acknowledge is that these pseudoscientists are brilliant storytellers.
They're so good. Yeah.
They're so good. And this is something we as a profession need to acknowledge and say, what do we need to do to be better so that the public listen to what we're saying and enjoys the story of how we tell the tales of the past, and that we are using it from a more structured, informed approach.
Yeah.
So it's about the storytelling more than anything else, which is why these TV shows do so well, because they first get the mystery, tantalize, like, you know, you're dangling a toy in front of the cat. Yeah. Then you bring them in, reel them in, and then you start to give them the facts slowly. And everyone's like, oh, wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
And you're just doing it in that storytelling way.
Yeah. Which, and I'd be interested to hear then. So I imagine, I think I can sort of guess what your answer would be, but just to say, because one of the other questions that came up when all of this stuff came about is people were asking, like, okay, but as professional archaeologists, should we actually engage with this material, like, not necessarily in the negative way, but in such a productive way, or should we just kind of ignore it? Because, you know, surely engaging with it is actually giving it a lot more publicity, you know, and all this kind of thing. I'm curious what your opinion on that is.
The archaeology community is small, so any input would be better than nothing. However, the input we see is nearly always just bashing them for basically being idiots. That's what you see when you read it. People are not, they're so direct where they're like, this person is talking nonsense, then I don't think it works. It's counteractive. And it's just not, that's why I don't like Twitter. And luckily now Twitter is kind of like gone. But when I used to just read, I just can't deal with this. It's just negative vibes. People are just nasty. And they're just happy to say this outright. Yeah. And you're hurting a lot of people's feelings in the way. And people are going to distrust archaeologists even more so and think that we're gatekeeping because we're not. People don't understand how long it takes for research to be published.
Yeah.
5 years, 10 years, 20 years, you know, 100 years. Like, it could take bloody ages
sometimes
for something to be published.
In between, and then you
exactly.
Have to, you know? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So I think trust needs to be built between the public, and they have this issue when you have people given a platform who have a large audience who listens to them, and the said person is saying archaeologists don't like me and our theories. Mm-hmm. You have to have then archaeologists come out and say, it's not that we don't like you, you know, it's that there's no substance behind what you are saying.
Yeah.
Where is the proof?
Yeah.
Where because for something to be pseudo, there's no evidence. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's all it is. That's all it comes down to. And even that in itself, people don't get sometimes.
Because they think there is evidence, but it's like, you're like, no, this is also interpretation. This isn't just.
But it's interpretation with zero facts.
Yeah.
Or it's interpretation with very little scope of maybe other settlements that also have a similar sort of setup where you could kind of say, okay, so if they made it like this, and, you know, we've got the settlement over here that did something similar, let's look at both.
Yeah.
There's none of that.
Yeah. Which, well, so one final question before we wrap up is, if, for example, other archaeologists might be listening in and thinking, okay, well, I do want to try and engage and, you know, like, become a bit more involved with sort of popular media outreach in that respect, because I do know a lot of people do find it hard to think even where to start, you know, or how to engage with non-archaeological communities in that way. What would be your sort of advice for those first steps in getting started with that kind of thing?
In 2020, I had the opportunity to work on The Great British Dig. We're 4 seasons in now. That started filming during the pandemic, so 2020. And the reason why I got that role, or the job, because I'm just being myself, I don't know. The reason why I got how I got that job was because they needed a field archaeologist. And I was a commercial field archaeologist at the time. And I was online, very active, talking about commercial field archaeology, as well as interviewing archaeologists around the world on my YouTube live show, Archaeologists in Quarantine. So I had quite a large social media presence. So if I remember correctly, I had like 4 different members of the team reach out to me in the space of a week through all my different social media platforms and email, because they had all found me in different ways. So that's definitely something to factor in as well. But the reason why I got that role was because of my actual working background, and the other archaeologists were in there, as well as the archaeological consultants. They knew of me anyway for some of the work that I had done. So it was not only having the social media presence, but also having the working presence, professional presence at the time, because I think I was working at Westminster Abbey at the time when they were doing the interviews, and when I was between filming, because, you know, we'd film 1 week and then 1 week off and I'd be at work back on site digging. So yeah, it was intense, but good fun.
See, I think it comes down to where you want your career to go or what you're passionate about. So for me, when I did archaeology, I wanted to find a way to get anyone and everyone to interact with the past in a way that was easy for them to understand, get rid of the academic jargon. And that was always a passion for me. So any opportunity as a commercial archaeologist to work on these community projects is always something I put myself forward for. Mm. And then I was known in every company, basically, that I would be the one, I'd be more than happy to be on the community project.
I'll just send Tash, she'll be fine.
Honestly, that is literally what happened at one point. I wouldn't even know about it. And I'll just hear this phrase and I'll be like, what am I doing now? And I'm like, oh, no, wicked, you know, and I get to talk to the public about this. Yeah. And it's literally those skills you need to get. So if you work in the commercial sector, which is developer-led projects, where the archaeology has to be done apart of planning permission, if you have the opportunity to do community projects, do it, because that's where you will learn how to speak to individuals and who you're speaking to. You will have to change the way you convey the information. You know, if you're speaking to a 7-year-old versus an 80-year-old, right, you have to speak in a different way. And that's where TV comes in, and people will scrutinize sometimes The Great British Dig because they think we oversimplify something. But what they don't understand is the point of the show is for individuals to be introduced into archaeology and to be inspired to read more.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's only 45 minutes or something, yeah, you know, to summarize a whole week's dig. And it's all about community members kind of getting involved. So it's not really oversimplification sometimes. You just need to know how to convey the information in a certain amount of time,
yeah,
and be concise. So those are the skills you need to gain. Learn how to speak to people in a way that's not degrading in any way. I know that's a really weird thing to say, but people do that. They really do speak down, and they don't need to. This is the thing. Most people who do that don't mean to when they start to explain something, but they do. And that's because, you know, when you go to a conference, you're seeing the same people over and over again. So you learn how to convey the information in a way that's for like-minded individuals who have similar research interests as yourself, or literally in the same discipline, same sub-discipline or another sub-discipline, right? You have your own language in itself. So it's been able to deconstruct that for the public masses. That's why social media is so good, because you're able to learn for yourself how to convey that information and what works for you and what you enjoy and what you don't enjoy doing. So especially now, everything has changed now with social media. And I would say now social media is really the best place to gain those skills, put yourself out there, because no one's going to give you a job, you know, just because you're like, oh, I want to be a presenter. It's not how it works anymore anyway. Yeah. You know, you really have to train. There are still people who like have family links or friends links, of course. You're always going to get that, especially in the main production houses. But for a lot of the panel shows and things like that, they're looking for people who generally specialize in something, but also put themselves out there online, because they want to see who this person is. Because, you know, I should say, when you get, this is kind of like a circle again, but when you get cast for a show, they've really kind of Googled who you are, and they're seeing the different types of content, if there is, about you, or if you specialize in something that they need for a show. That's how you kind of pop up on their search. And, you know, you have like a Zoom call with the casting team, and that's it. yeah. one off, you know, they might ask you some questions and then that's it. And then again, they're going to use your reference from what you have online yeah. to see, so okay, who is this person?
A sort of strong background in that already, or a strong presence online, and you've shown that you've tried to take the effort to get those skills, then yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, as you will know, Matilda, like, the more content we make, the more podcasts you do, the interviewing techniques, you learn as you do it, and you yeah. become better yeah. and you know how to steer a conversation. Like, how many yeah. times did I go waffle on? Because it's not my podcast. If it was my podcast, I would have to be like, you know, tuned in and like make sure it stays in. But it's not my one, so it's fine.
On that topic,
it probably is, you know. But anyway, if you want to do be TV presenter now or work in TV, I would say start with social media and go from there now, because that's kind of the way in. Everything's completely changed in the last few years. People who are on social media now, I've seen, bearing in mind, as I said, I've worked in TV, I've had experience of it since 2016, 2017 time as yeah. like my kind of side hustle. Whilst being a full-time commercial archaeologist, I've seen how it's changed in the last 2 years since the pandemic.
Yeah.
People who have social media presence are getting more work than people who are experts in the said field, who would be good to even convey that information if they had the opportunity. They're just not online. Right. They're just not making the content. So yeah. these social media individuals are getting the work, and they are not necessarily equipped. They're yeah. not equipped. You yeah. know, they're just reading off the random script. Yeah. that they've Googled and, yeah. and that's it. However, and I'm not, and that's quite bad maybe for me to say it that way, but it's true. Generally speaking, there's a lot of individuals who do that. Of course, there's other individuals who make these amazing content and they have great, yeah, you know.
Do the proper research.
They do proper yeah. research. They put the sources in their captions. I'll be honest, I don't always put the sources in my captions. Yeah, but
we
the point
you,
is, yeah, I mean, I make mistakes. You know, everyone makes mistakes.
Yeah.
But there are people who literally have no archaeology background, history background, and they're getting the platform because, yeah. sorry, they're getting the opportunities because they have the platform.
Yeah.
So archaeologists, historians, anyone who specializes in something out there who wants to convey this information, don't be annoyed by people you see online conveying something in popular media if you are not online doing exactly. it yourself.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I think that that's very, very good advice. And indeed, we do actually have to have to wrap up because it's getting towards the end of our tea break. But thank you so, so much for joining me today, Tash. I really, really appreciated you taking the time out to come and speak to me today.
Of course, anytime.
And if anyone wants to find out more about Tash's work and projects, the Sutton Hoo helmet and burial, any of the other things we've talked about today, check out the show notes on the podcast homepage. If there's something, by the way, you ever think I've missed, feel free to get in contact and let me know. And I can always add things later as well. So I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If, by the way, you fancy helping to support this show and all of the other amazing series that form the Archaeology Podcast Network, because we always do try to do proper research and make sure that we present valid and relevant information to the public, as well as being informative and entertaining, you can become an APN member. And that helps us to create even more free, amazing content. We'll also have exclusive access to ad-free episodes. You can have access to bonus content like our quarterly online seminars. For more information, just check out the homepage, archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. And you can also join our brand new Discord server and continue the conversation afterwards. So maybe see you there. If not, see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
I hope that you enjoyed our journey today. If you did, make sure to like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and I'll see you next month for another episode of Tea Break Time Travel.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.